So I'm Austin Angel from Arizona State University, and I've worked in super cool liquids and glasses of all different sorts for quite a long time, and interested quite a lot in non-liquid phenomena which are related to these, and I intend to talk about them quite a bit today. So anyway, what's the rule here? Do I go? Yeah. Am I free to to talk? Okay.
I'll stop you when we have questions.
It's a physics workshop, so I feel that I have to justify myself a little as a chemist. So I'm going to blow the trumpet for ASU a little bit, and by looking at our rankings on the national scene, as judged by publications in Science and Nature in the last 5 years. And you see, we rank fairly well, or I wouldn't be showing it, obviously. So this is the, now I sent in a title which was this one down here, but ended up retreating to a more completely developed title here, which incorporates much of the same thing and didn't require me to reconstruct quite as much as I would need it to. A fairly lengthy title, but it involves some developments which are going on in the field at the moment, some involving myself, some involving many other people, in which we aim, and this will be one of my principal points, to look at some fundamental differences between liquids of the different types which are frequently spoken of as fragile liquids as compared with strong liquids, trying to make the point that they're not just extremes of a pattern, but actually they're opposites in an interesting way. And that'll be my main point, but it'll introduce me, it'll bring up very much the question of liquid-liquid phase transitions. And there are some very interesting trends in metallic glass findings at the moment, some of which are not published, but which are in press, which I want to mention in the course of this, which I think have the potential to put liquid-liquid or metallic glass systems at the center of this phenomenological scene in viscous liquids. And I'll try and make that point as we go along. Was that? That was not mine. Same noise that I get when I need charging, so. So I'm aiming for a fairly big picture, and I run the danger of getting losing the track, as I want to bring many different aspects of the phenomenology of both plastic crystals and disordering alloys and liquids together. And so the range is large, and I'm going to have to try very hard to keep the focus along the way. So the talk's going to be focused not so much on behavior below the glass transition temperature, which I think a lot of the work being discussed here is concerned with, but on metastable and stable state behavior, which is temperature above TG, but with some predictions about what happens below the normal TG under equilibrium conditions, because this is an important element of the liquid-liquid business, one of the most interesting ones involving what I'm calling Edinger phases at the moment, which I'll explain when we get to them. But it offers a new resolution of the Karsman paradox for the case of fragile liquids, and that's one of the more long-lasting aspects of the field. So let's see how that develops. Here's an example of a very nice simple system, carbon disulfide, which is almost a glass former, and which can be studied over very wide ranges of temperature. Here's 14 orders of magnitude of relaxation time for a system which is simple enough to be compared with metallic glasses with their atomic particles. And so we're not going to look at what happens below TG too much, but we'll focus on this range up here. This is not pure carbon disulfide, actually. It's carbon disulfide mixed with a little bit of this four-atom system just to make it a little bit happier in the liquid state, so we can have no problem in getting glasses from it and determining their properties. All right, so I start with an observation attributed to Einstein, although nobody so far has been able to identify the exact place where he said this, so it's clouded in mystery, but nevertheless it's a very nice quote that Einstein could easily have made if he didn't actually make it. If you'd understand the phenomenon, but you only allowed one type of measurement, to study it, choose the heat capacity. And you'll see a lot of heat capacities in this talk today, because I'm a disciple of that line of thought. And my outline is that I want to talk about some basic concepts which most people will be familiar with, so I can be fairly brief there. And then in the search for elucidation of difficult points, we're going to depart from standard glass-forming liquids in two different directions. One focused on colloids, where some recent stuff on correlation lengths, static correlation lengths, which is very much in my theme, have been published. And then I want to pass to disordering alloy superlattices, where a lot is known, because this is the familiar lambda transition type of thing, and we're going to gain something from that, because we're going to look at a system with a lambda transition, but which also has a very strong glass transition, which traps the system partway through the ordering process in a way which is going to be interesting for our purposes. And that's then going to give me the right to go back and talk about liquid-liquid transitions, both ones you can see and ones that are hidden below TG. And finally, having said this, I'm going to turn to some data on light scattering and neutron scattering as a sort of a proof of at least a part of what I'm saying. So that's the big menu. Here's where we start always, and probably unnecessary, but at full equilibrium we're dealing with a system that's at the bottom of its free energy valley in the supercooled liquid state. We're still at the bottom of the free energy valley, but it's no longer the lowest one, and when we get into the glassy state, lower down, 15 orders of magnitude lower, longer in time, then we get stuck up on the edge of the free energy valley, which is also not the lowest free energy valley. So this state is lacking in respectability, although it's gaining a lot of interest at the moment. So the glass transition, which is where it gets stuck. How definitive a phenomenon is it? Well, it depends very much what sort of glass-forming liquid you look at. And this is a strong point where I want to start. If you look at a molecular liquid like 1-pentene, also a very simple liquid, then if you're using Einstein's heat capacity, then it's a very, very striking phenomenon. The heat capacity decreases by over to less than half its liquid state value, and it happens in a very narrow range of temperature, and so it's striking. What you see depends on which way you go through it. Of course, this is typical of what you see with DSC, but I'm not going to pay too much attention to the process of ergodicity breaking today. Rather, I want to make the contrast between that system and a classical system, silica, the driest variety. The properties of silica glass are quite dependent on how much water is stuck in the lattice, because that breaks bonds. There's nothing quite as dry as a computer simulation which has no water in it. And so this is the behavior of really dry silica, as studied by Horbach and Binder and Kobe, I think, was involved in this also. In ranges where the experimentalists can't study it. And they get, this is the vibrational heat capacity, which of course is experimental. And you can see then this excess heat capacity above the vibrational limit is a function which is going the opposite way from this one. Instead of increasing as you go down in temperature, it's decreasing as you come down in temperature, and it's essentially going to vanish at the glass temperature. But in the laboratory, the glass temperature is dealing with real silica, which is slightly damaged by the presence of water, and so you can see a perceptible jump, but it's still small compared with the others. So we have this big contrast. Beryllium fluoride is another case of one of these network liquids with almost invisible glass transition. So we have to deal with that, because these are obviously prime examples of glass-forming liquids, and yet they've got very little thermodynamic signature of the glass transition. So this is a quantity which is very variable. Here's a typical molecular liquid. Here's the first metallic glass that was shown to have a glass transition. It's a very pronounced one, gold silicon, a big jump, and then this decreasing total heat capacity with a background of classical heat capacity from the vibrational degrees of freedom. A typical chalcogenide glass, which has got a fairly temperature independent heat capacity jump, and then these network losses that I've just been talking about. And these data then can be used to generate a family of glass formers by using not the heat capacity itself, which is dangerous, but a integrated form, the entropy, or it's particularly the excess of entropy over the entropy of the crystal, because we're not interested in the vibrational contributions to this heat capacity. We're interested in the part which comes from the structure. And so here's the typical picture of the entropy, total entropy of the liquid, with the crystalline part here, a jump at heat at the melting point, and then the liquid which generates this chasm paradox by virtue of appearing to want to cross the crystalline value at positive at finite temperatures. The value of the entropy at the top of the energy landscape that we talk about, well, for simple particles here, it's with the number of configurations exponentiating with the number of particles, so we end up with approximately R per mole of excitable units. If there's just atoms, it's R, but if it's dimers, then it's going to be roughly 2R, according to Speedy and Sillinger, because it's E to the alpha N configurations, where alpha is this number which depends on the complexity of the excitable unit. Now, I want to look at these data in an unusual way to set up, and I'm going to be talking mostly thermodynamics today. And although most of the interest has come in the dynamics, I want to push this problem back to the thermodynamics, because thermodynamics is much more tractable, and I want to show you that the same problems which we are used to talking about in the dynamics are right there in the thermodynamics. So that's this next step right now. So I want to represent this excess entropy scaled by the excess entropy at glass temperature against inverse temperature. This is the scaled temperature which has been used in displaying the transport data and generating this concept of strong versus fragile liquids. And I want to do the same thing using purely thermodynamic material. So I'm going to use this excess entropy here for the variety of liquids and plot it in this fashion here. And when I do that, we see something which is familiar in form, starting with something with a small temperature dependence and ending at the other end of the scale with liquids which we have been calling fragile liquids because of the very rapid change with temperature of the property under consideration. If this is the top of the energy landscape here, which we've been excited to, then that's these liquids down here rushing in this direction towards the top of the energy landscape, driven by their thirst for entropy, as we are accustomed to describing it in landscape terms. So here, a set of liquids. These are the same liquids in which the viscosity is plotted against inverse temperature scale by the glass temperature, where the glass temperature is defined by the calorimetric thing, rather than by reaching a particular value of viscosity. That's why they're not all going through the same point here. And that compares with the same set of liquids over here plotted, where it's the purely thermodynamic quantity that's plotted. And the order is the same. So if this is an interesting pattern to discuss, then the thermodynamics is equally interesting, and presumably the two are closely tied together. So this is the representation that Frank and Pablo gave it in Nature. Yeah?
I didn't get the explanation for why these points not. Could you go back to the previous slide?
Yeah.
So why are they not going through the same?
Here, because in this case, they're defined to go through the same point because TG is defined by the jump in heat capacity. But the viscosity clearly is not tied completely to the heat capacity. There's some decoupling between the viscous flow process, which is a composite. I mean, this is a product of a infinite frequency shear modulus and a relaxation time. And so why should they all have exactly the same value at the thermodynamic glass transition?
So here in this data, so I mean, the range from TG to whatever high temperature you're looking at of excess entropy seems to be about a factor of 5. Is that how large it gets?
This ratio here.
Yeah.
Well, that's how large it gets for the very fragile liquids. But the...
Is this a good representation of most of the glass formers?
This is the most fragile liquid I could find, actually, yes. It's intended to cover the entire range. Yeah. This incorporates many, many, many more liquids, because one of the problems in making this plot here is that you need to have the excess entropy at the glass temperature, and often the data have not been measured over the entire supercooled range, but what has been measured is the entropy of fusion. So this product here, delta H divided by Tg, is the entropy, is sort of a crude version of this excess entropy at Tg over here, and allows us to correlate many more liquids with respect to the measured dynamic fragility and this calculated from the pure thermodynamic properties. So the idea is that there is this close relationship between the fragility measured in dynamics and the fragility measured in thermodynamics, and this gives us the right to focus attention on the thermodynamics, which is a much more tractable problem, in my humble opinion. And it allows us to bring in systems which intrinsically you can't measure the viscosity in, like the different alloy system, but you can measure the thermodynamics. So that's our, our line of thought. And it's important to realize that you're going to get into trouble if you just look at correlation with heat capacity, because that fragility is only correlated with a large delta Cp if the entropy of fusion is also is normal, taken into account. We need to ratio the two, as you do in this diagram here. And I say that very deliberately, because a number of attempts have been made to correlate the viscosity based fragility with just jumps in heat capacity, and it's very easy to show you get a scatter pattern that way. And that's because you're neglecting to introduce the entropy in the scaling. So fragile liquids are liquids with which in terms of structure are falling to pieces very rapidly, and they're rushing towards the top of the energy landscape, driven by entropy, but I'm not going to really talk about what it is that makes one liquid more fragile than the rest. It's one of the problems of the field, but I'm abandoning that in favor of something I consider more important, which is to ask, instead, are the strong liquids just extremes, or are they opposites? And I want to show that they're opposites, and I want to show they differ by having correlation lengths which vary in opposite direction with respect to the glass transition. Let's see. So fluctuations and the correlation lengths are the static fluctuations. Sorry, the static correlations are the ones I'm interested in, the ones which relate to the thermodynamics, compressibility, well-known relationships. But we know that there's this contrast between the density fluctuations, which are what are generally thought not to be related to the glass transition, and the enthalpy fluctuations, which I think very much are. And I started off with this slide on the pentene large jump in heat capacity, and I want to contrast that for them here with the behavior of the compressibility, which reflects the density fluctuations. These ones are increasing as we go towards Tg. These ones appear to be decreasing. There's not much data, but they seem to be decreasing as we go towards Tg, denying that they're much very important. And here is a further confirmation of that from a fragile liquid orthoterfenyl, where the compressibility has been measured. You see the liquid is decreasing with temperature more rapidly than the glassy contribution is increasing, so the difference between them is decreasing, showing that the density fluctuations are not...
Those were adiabatic compressibility.
The previous one was adiabatic and was the first ones I ever saw, but these are static compressibilities. These are isothermal compressibilities from just pressure volume measurements. And unfortunately, there are not many in the literature. I've been making efforts to get more data on this question, but they're not there. But what are there are completely consistent with the general idea that density fluctuations are not the important quantity in seeking to understand, which is why everybody's turned to the dynamic heterogeneities, and because of the lack of anything interesting in the static ones. But well, I'll bring some other attention to this. And so this is all a bit of a mystery, like the Easter Island. I sense the need for a bit of a break, so I just take the opportunity straight after going to Srikant's workshop. I took my wife to Easter Island for her 50th birthday, and because we'd both been mystified by this, but one of the things you don't realize, you often see these pictures there, but you don't see these ones. This is one of these guys still in the crater wall, where they were digging them out. This big crater has got many of these giants waiting to be extracted, and for some reason or other they stopped doing the work, and that's one of the mysteries of Easter Island, and it's a fitting break for us, because now we want to, in our search for understanding here, turn to get to some non-standard cases, and they're going to be colloids and rotator phases in the crystalline state and disordering alloy, superlattice, which have phenomena closely related to what we are interested in and can help us in our search for understanding. So we come up against this question of correlation static or dynamic, because most of the discussion of correlation lengths that you'll hear and see in the literature relate to dynamic correlations. But there are people like myself, and particularly Tanaka, Hajime Tanaka, in a recent Nature Materials, that are saying that the static correlations are really very important if you're looking at the right ones. And the right ones in his search, which involved colloidal glass formers, were correlations in the hexatic order function. So I need to talk just a minute about this, the colloidal glass formers. Have to remember that they're distinguished from the regular glass formers by having their principal particles suspended in a small molecule liquid. Their behavior can be hard sphere-like if they don't absorb the solvent, but if they absorb the solvent and are spongy and change with temperature, then they can behave in a quite different fashion. Hard sphere colloids like hard sphere liquids, the packing fraction is the important thing, but the soft spheres can distort under pressure and behave in a completely fragile system. And we see this picture recently from Dave Waitz's Nature publication showing the strong, fragile, equivalent behavior of their colloids. And this picture here makes the comparison with the volume fraction dependence of viscosity in glass-forming liquids, where you have intermediate behavior and fragile behavior, and they're the same ones which are fragile in the isothermal volume dependence as in the isobaric temperature dependence. So we're entitled to look at colloids, and then we look at colloids. That's the actual data from the liquids. This is the recent paper of Tanaka and his co-workers looking at a polydisperse colloid and examining the hexatic order, where they find it to be very heterogeneous, and they plot their correlation length for the hexatic order parameter in this fashion to illustrate its temperature dependence, and they find that all of their different systems can be correlated, and there's a sort of a critical behavior going on there involving this structure, and it's a static correlation length they're talking about. Pardon?
This length scale is determined how?
The length scale, sorry.
How is that determined?
It's his
axis, I guess.
This is from, well, this is the pictorial representation. Just exactly how he's pulled out the length from this procedure, I'm not sure.
But hexatic order parameter correlation.
But it's, yes, it's from this size 6 parameter.
It's a locally average size 6.
So I'm assuming that they've pulled it out okay. So they say that this, they call it the medium range crystalline order in this. So they're seeing hexatic-like order in a two-dimensional representation. And they're saying that this is diverging. As temperature goes towards the T-naught of the Vogel-Fulcher equation for their relaxation time. So, but it's the point I'm wanting to make is here's somebody now looking, focusing attention on static correlation lengths and saying that the static correlation length, which is determining the properties of this colloidal system, because I also want to focus some attention on the static correlation, so I'm looking for some help.
What is that lowercase d? Is that dimension?
It's the dimensionality, because he's depicting it in two dimensions. You can see it much more easily there.
But are they claiming that that holds for other dimensions too, then?
Well, he's got 3D, he's got 2D and 3D, and he says they're all doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. This is a paper from February of this year. Yeah?
How do these particles interact?
They're essentially half spheres. They're hard colloids.
You have temperature variables.
These are polydispersed.
Yes, he's got pictures in there which show the more polydispersed, the more frustrated it is, the stronger it behaves in the sense. So I guess I have to say I'm not
sure. Temperature is irrelevant.
That's right, but in some way he's cast it in the form.
Elements to the
that's what I figured. It must be, but it's the usual binary line.
PC must be the polydispersed.
PC is polydispersed colloids.
And I just wanted to make quickly the point that it doesn't have to be crystalline order. You can make systems with hard particles, oblates, spheroids, for instance, that don't want to pack ever in crystalline order, but will still interact like this. I think that you can still have high-density packings without them being crystalline, and that those fluctuations apply in those cases. But I don't think I shouldn't spend time on that issue. So now I want to look for some additional help in this area by looking not at fragile polymers, which I did just for the sake of getting this correlation length, static correlation length, up in the air, but for looking at systems which are more strong in their behavior, because I can then make a lot of use of the glass transition in some of these other crystalline ordering systems. So let's look at two classes, rotator phases, which are generally called plastic crystals, and then I'll turn to the lambda transitions in disordering alloys. Now that's my intention here, with help from non-standard cases. Just to illustrate what we're talking about, here's our depiction of a liquid, which can become a supercooled liquid, and a glass with disorder in both centers of mass and orientations, or the alternative is that it can undergo a partial crystallization to center of mass order, but retain the disordering, which then will end up getting frozen in at a glassy crystal transition. And this phenomenology here is what I want to take a look at right now, because it's been characterized by many people, and it's has all the characteristics of the viscous liquid state, except that it doesn't flow. It has the heterogeneity that we're accustomed to talking about. It has the state-dependent relaxation. It has the strong and fragile behavior and its temperature dependence, but it's dominated by a behavior on the strong end of things rather than on the fragile end of things. And that's a clue. Here again is the correlation with the jump in heat capacity, where the more fragile examples have bigger jumps in heat capacity when normalized to the glass transition, to the glassy state heat capacity. And here's a recent example I found for dimethyl cyclohexane, very, very nice. And here's the liquid heat capacity. This is the heat capacity of the intermediate plastic crystal, which looks just like the one butene case that I was showing you earlier, with the jump in heat capacity increasing as you go to lower temperatures, and presumably correlated with some increasing correlation length as you go to lower temperatures. And here's a particularly interesting case where we don't have a glass transition down this part, but we have a lambda transition just before the melting point, suggesting that this phenomenology may be part of the same plastic crystal scenario. In fact, the strong members are typically ones which come from behavior like this, and some of them, if you look at high temperatures, you'll actually see a lambda transition. But I won't get to that for a little while. And here's where I'm in danger of losing the track. I've switched from the rotator phase plastic crystals now to another example which is of particular interest, which is the order-disorder transition in a very simple system of cobalt atoms and iron atoms at the mole ratio 1:1.
Yeah. Can you just go back to the previous slide? So
yes.
What is the message of this transition here? So where is it? So you're saying this is what happens when there is a glass transition. This is the same system or not?
This is actually very closely related. This is one. These are all cyclic paraffins with additional stuff stuck to two of the carbons. So here is a cyclohexane with two methyl groups in the one position and two position. And it gives you a system in which you have this intermediate plastic crystalline phase. If we switch the position of just one of those methyl groups, we can change the phenomenology so that instead of having a plastic crystal phase with a big jump in heat capacity, you have something which way down here will have a very tiny jump in heat capacity, and then this lambda transition just before melting. And there are other cases.
Before what melting? The crystal melting.
Before the crystal melts to the liquid, yeah. And the suspicion is that if you could prevent the melting of the other members of this family, this would probably be the common event at the end. In other words, these rotator phases are the bottom half of lambda transitions cut off by the melting transitions. And you'll see how this fits into the picture as I get to the next group of disordering systems, which are these metal alloys. Oh, but I should mention.
So what is the nature of that transition? This is basically this transition.
This transition here is the runaway rotational disordering of the 1,4-dimethylcyclohexane molecules.
So why is that not the glass transition for the system?
Well, this obviously isn't going to have a time dependence in it. You'll be able to get a rotational relaxation time from it. But this one, rather than getting arrested dynamically at some point while the heat capacity is high, it's only going to get arrested at some very low temperature down here. And you'll see this coming up. This is actually rather like the water situation. But again, this is the danger I'm in, because I'm trying to throw big chunks of phenomenology from different points, and I've got to make the challenge to me is to make the connections between them as I go. And I'm not confident I'm going to be able to do that to everyone's satisfaction, but let me just keep trying. The next one's a little bit more transparent. I think I'll leave that last. No, I won't. Again, a cyclohexane with two additional methyl groups, but instead of being individually on the ring at different points, they're together in an ethyl group, and this guy is a glass former. This is the behavior of a supercooled liquid. No plastic crystals now. So by these very tiny adjustments in the geometry of the species of interest, you can get this whole range of different phase transition behavior. And don't tell me there aren't links between them, because there almost have to be. And it's looking for those links, which is what's behind this search here. So let's go to this guy. This is from the 1943 literature in Japan, actually. And what's striking about it is not the lambda transition here, because that was all the rage. The first half of the last century was devoted to understanding that sort of transition. But mostly those things just go down to third law behavior without any problems. But in this particular case, the system gets stuck halfway down. It gets stuck in a glass transition, or something which has got all the elements of the glass transition in it. These different curves here just show what it looks like during heating after different quenching behaviors. It's all predictable from what we know about regular glass-forming liquids. So if we're going to understand glass transitions, better take a look at this system too, which is exactly what we've done in collaboration with Ralph Busch and his student Shuwei in Germany recently, using standard differential scanning calorimetry techniques to get a handle on the disordering kinetics now. On what's the kinetics of this disordering? How does it relate to strong and fragile liquids? So we can do that quite simply. No need to take the time. There's a tricky way of plotting the data for different quenching rates and uniform heating rate, which gives us an Arrhenius plot with the fragility, the slope of the line. You have to take this on faith. But the dynamic behavior of this system is very, very simple. It's the strong liquid extreme. It behaves like silica does in its viscosity. This slope here is the slope of an ideal Arrhenius equation with a pre-exponent of 10 to the minus 13 seconds, the vibrational time scale. So the disordering in this glass transition here is behaving just like an ideal strong liquid. Now, what does it mean? Let's go a little bit more. We can prove that what's getting trapped here is just the lower half of the lambda transition by doing annealing experiments and dealing out. Bill Johnson's group at Caltech does this quite a lot, and extracting the heat capacity below the glass transition. It just continues the lambda transition. There's good, from ancient theory, good descriptions of this from Kirkwood.
Lambda transition is this Ising model transition?
Yes, that's all.
And so below that you're seeing some domain growth problems? Or?
Below that what?
If you quench some Ising model from high temperature to low temperature, then there will be some domain growth kinetics, slow kinetics at low temperature.
It's I think the details of what state of disorder you trap is going to depend on what sort of system you're looking at. But those rotator phases that I'm talking about, you trap by the dynamics. This is the coupling between the dynamics and the thermodynamics, which is one of the things which is not completely understood at this point. But in this case, most of the lambda transitions, you don't trap the disorder in the system until you get to very low states of disorder. But in this particular case, you're trapping it while the heat capacity is still high. And so you're seeing this glass transition right out in the open, and you've got to do something about it. You can't just brush it under the carpet like has happened in most of the cases of lambda transitions.
Right. And then the question is, what does lambda transition mean in what you're saying? Because if it's an Ising transition, so...
This is the... Well, you're simply
binary
trapping the spins in a... Pardon?
Binary alloy transition, or a disorder transition, should be the Ising transition.
Yes.
So that's where, equilibrium, you have this lambda transition corresponding to the order disorder of the binary alloy.
That's right. At this point, you've lost the distinction between the two individual lattices on which the cobalt and the iron sit at low temperatures. There you've got two interpenetrating simple cubic lattices, and at high temperatures, you can't distinguish them because the disorder is complete. Yeah? And the question that I'm interested in is the correlation length here, because we know it. I mean, we know about Ising. And so I'm going to be able to tell you about which way the correlation length is changing here. And nobody's going to argue with me because it's a known thing, huh? That's the advantage of doing this. So if I can, but before I go on and do that, I want to relate this now back to a very popular glass former, and that's water.
Sorry.
Yeah.
This is what Chandan is going for, but if you're looking at a fixed composition system and you go through this transition,
yeah.
what I mean, so eventually you will have phase of composition separated crystals?
No. You'll have a completely ordered superlattice. Mm-hmm. With the cobalt atoms arranged on one of the interpenetrating simple cubic lattices and the iron arranged on the other.
That's
the ground state.
Yeah. This is the antiferromagnetic, not the ferromagnetic.
And so it's a non-conserved order parameter in this case, right? Spinodal decomposition, for example, would be something with a conserved order parameter.
Yeah, that's what I was
but here, the order parameter is not conserved, I think.
So there's no non-equilibrium dynamics that's going on above.
There is non-equilibrium dynamics.
There are two equivalent states where A is one and B is other, and the interchange, there's another ground state or order state, and there are the domains of these different kinds.
So we got the dynamics. We showed that it was these simple Arrhenius kinetics that are disordering here, Bose Arrhenius equation, despite the fact that the configurational heat capacity is changing dramatically with temperature. So the Adam Gibbs equation is not going to help you with this one.
Between the TG and the lambda transition, what you're looking at is an ordered crystal, right? This AB ordered crystal.
AB ordered down here, yes. Oh, well, I'm sorry. It's the ordering is trapped here at this glass transition. Yeah. But if there was infinite
glass transition and the lambda transition, you have an ordered crystal with a temperature dependent degree of order.
Yes, it's certainly center of mass order. Yeah. Yeah. So we know exactly what the excitations are in this case. It's rather simple. So then the question is, which way is the correlation length changing as TG is approached in this case? Well, we know the answer. It's increasing as you go towards the lambda transition point. And then the interesting thing is that sort of form of heat capacity is really what you deduce for a controversial system like water, and I'll show you it's not too different from what you get for viscous liquid silica, which is the granddaddy of all the glass formers. Yeah? So, and that's going to provoke the question, which way is the static correlation length changing in silica? And the answer is going to be in a way which would make light scattering decrease in silica fibers the lower the fictive temperature. And I can turn to the literature and show you that's the case. So the prediction, this is turning out to be useful because it gives us the basis for a prediction which can be verified and which then is practically useful, especially if you're interested in giant lasers and laser fusion and scattering of energy. So that was another appropriate point to take a rest because it gets a bit exhausting as you try and put this all together. And this is what you fly over if you go to the far west of China instead of stopping in Beijing where Wei has such wonderful restaurants and where we all enjoy going from time to time. You just keep flying for many, many more hours out the west, you get to Urumqi and then a little bit further on you cross over these mountains on the way to the Eli State University, where I had the pleasure of spending 3 weeks a couple of summers ago.
That's taken from the airplane?
And that's taken from the airplane, yeah.
By you?
By me. And that's the top of the landscape. So that's there because I want now to turn to liquid-liquid transitions, because I've been talking about transitions in which I know something about. And I want to talk about transitions that I don't know too much about, but I'm hoping to know more about at the end of the line because of this previous excursion. And I'll do a bit of the proving it down there. And the metal glasses are going to come back in strong at the end there. So let's go back to liquids and try and paint the big picture. So I need to remind you of one end of the picture is this very sharply defined glass transition. And at the other end is the case of silica, where the glass transition is so small, but there is a peak. Binder and Coe didn't plot their last point for some reason or other, because they probably didn't have a very good feeling for why it had a peak. But we put it in, and here's the corresponding case of beryllium fluoride.
Did they measure that point? Or did you see that point?
That was in their paper. They just didn't put it on this plot. But we'd put such points on plots before, because this is beryllium fluoride, where we have a lot of measured data going halfway up to the top, whereas in silica, we've only got a little bit of measured data here. But beryllium fluoride is a network liquid like silica, but just the charge is divided in two. And So it's got a much lower glass temperature, and so we've got data there. This is what they look like. Almost no glass transition. For a long time, people said beryllium fluoride didn't have a calorimetric glass transition. And then there's some simple simulations which Peter Poole has verified, which show you the sharp peak there. So this is a feature of the thermodynamics of one of our strong liquids. And of course, I want to relate it to the peak in the lambda transitions I've just been talking about. But let's put this in a big canvas, first of all, because I want to try and convince you that there's some systematics in this. That these network liquids, which previously had only been thought about here, but now I'm showing you have this peak here, which is like a smeared out version of our lambda transition peak, are the strong liquid end. Here's the fragile liquid end, with a big mystery about what happens below the glass transition, because the red line here is the glass transition, and the vertical line here is the predicted first order transition for the equilibrated supercooled liquid, as predicted from a theoretical treatment of the excitations in fragile liquids, which I'll say a little bit more about in a little while, because again, there's something to help prove it in the form of some new data on glasses formed from the vapor. But I can't jump to that yet. Let me get there in two or three steps. And in the middle is my water case, which I'm seeing as a Rosetta Stone for this whole picture. Because in the case of water, we know from the supercooled studies we have this very fragile behavior in the supercooled region, and then you can't see the peak because it always crystallizes there, unless you make it nanoconfined. When it forgets how to crystallize, it's no longer exactly like bulk water, but it's certainly got a lot to do with it, because it's got a peak in the heat capacity, which I showed you a couple of pictures back, both by direct measurement and by thermodynamic deduction from what's known about that and what's known about that. This is Francis Starr's thesis. And this down here is a calorimetric study from Japanese adiabatic calorimetry on nanoconfined water. And also from this cement paste water of Chen's, and that there's a number of people have measured this, and this is for real as a experimental phenomenon. All right, back to where we are. So there's water sitting in the middle. And this is almost critical in its behavior. This has been the center of all this discussion, and this is the way the entropy goes. And the glass transition, if you trap it, this is why there's been such a controversy about the glass transition of water, because it's down in the tail end of this lambda-like transition. Almost nothing left. Its entropy, excess entropy, is barely measurable. It's almost a third law substance. All right, this is a picture which I'm now going to try and justify in more detail. But first, talking correlation lengths, this is our cobalt ion one again, where we know from all the stuff on the Ising model has correlation lengths which increase both as we come down from above and as we go up from below. Yeah, everyone will agree with that, I think. The static correlation lengths we're talking about. So here is a case with a glass transition where the static correlation length is increasing as you go away from the glass transition. And that's a key point that I want to leave you with. So we can draw in the arrows for the directions of the correlation, the static correlation lengths in these different systems then. In the middle here, we've got just what I was saying with fragile on one side, with the correlation lengths both pointing towards the peak. In our fragile liquids, well, the interesting transition, what's left of this is down below the glass transition. So the correlation lengths going in the way everybody wants them to is fine. But then going up on the other side, where the measurable domain is always below the peak, then the correlation lengths are increasing as you go away from the glass transition. Which means if you're interested in light scattering and in minimizing that light scattering, you anneal your glass to the lowest possible fictive temperature, so that the correlation lengths which will scatter the light are minimized. And one of my later pictures shows you that this is what the optical fiber people are finding. The liquid-liquid transition below TG, I want to spend just a little bit on this now, and I go back to this ethyl cyclohexane, which is one of the members of this hexane decorated with something else, two ethyl groups. So here is ethyl benzene, which is a very fragile liquid, which is an aromatic version of this molecule here. Both of them are cycles. This one paraffin, this one aromatic. This one, a very fragile liquid. This one, a not very fragile liquid. Now, what distinction can we make between them? Well, first of all, I want to tell you what this guy, my colleague Dmitry Matyushev, with the model which is based on excitations, with a Gaussian distribution of excitations, no time to talk in detail, but the equations that he comes up with fitting simultaneously the excess entropy and the excess heat capacity are telling us that we cannot account for these data unless we put in a first order phase transition terminating the de-excitation process. And it's occurring 10 to 20% below the measured last transition. And when you say something like this, everybody's going to throw up your hands and say, well, what's the point of talking about something you can't observe? But as of the last few months, we're starting to be able to observe something down there by taking advantage of the high mobility of molecules on the surface of condensed phases. And this has been the particular discovery of Mark Ettinger and his group, who are not committing themselves to this point of view by any means, but I'm using their data in this direction, and I want to make a prediction for you, which you can see when the data comes out is good or not, and it involves these two guys here, because this one's very fragile, and Dmitry's equations will say it's going to have a first order phase transition 10 to 20% below TG, and this one's not, so it won't. So the prediction is that whatever Ettinger sees for ethyl benzene, he won't see for ethyl cyclohexane. That was a prediction made to Professor Ishii and his group in Japan, who were studying this phenomenon of ultra-stable glasses, as Ettinger has called them, using small molecules that have their glass temperatures down around 100 Kelvin out of the range that Mark Ettinger's apparatus was telling. So Ettinger discovered the thing in the first place for big molecules, but Ishii quickly followed it with the same phenomenon, which I'm now going to talk about, for the small molecules, like ethyl benzene. What they find is, first of all, the glass transition temperature is 118 Kelvin for ethyl benzene. If you deposit the glass from the vapor at 77 Kelvin, you measure a volume which is much greater than the normal liquid volume. You incorporate voids and stuff in the structure. This is what everybody thought was the rule for vapor deposited glasses. It was like an ultra fast quench. So you got an ultra low density glass. But as you raise the temperature of the deposition, and God knows how this went undiscovered for so long, but as you raise the temperature of the deposition towards the glass temperature, when you get to about 10 or 20% below it, my gosh, you're depositing a glass which is denser than anything that you could get in 100,000 years of annealing. How do you account for it? It's almost as dense as the crystal. And when you raise the temperature, it doesn't return to the liquid state until significantly above the glass transition. So it's not only ultra-dense, but it's ultra-low mobility. Those molecules are packed together, they're jammed, and they don't want to move until you give them more thermal energy than you normally have to. This is, you can see these ones are all easily returning to the normal liquid state. But these ones here, so it looks, Ettinger has a lot of studies on his systems, and as he writes about it, you would conclude that the return from this state to this state is occurring by a process of nucleation and growth. With a 100 micron, roughly 1 micron, I think, dimensions in the densities, in the separation of density centers. Anyway, there's quite a lot of literature gathering there. But this looks very much like a transition from one amorphous state to another distinct amorphous state. And the second one, of course, is the normal glass. So this has got a really good possibility of being the second liquid phase of this prediction. And As I've just said, it will predict. In fact, there's data there, but I'm not really at liberty to talk about them because they've not been published yet. I've just been given the privilege. So, but
can you play around with how long he waits to see his transition? That's a very fascinating thing. He's somehow got a super saturated glassy phase, or I know it's super saturated.
super dense. Yes, he's broken through the kinetic barrier to.
He's joined us by this vapor deposition.
Yes. And there's a lot of evidence that molecules on the surface are very mobile, but apparently, and Pablo de Benedetti is now in this business, and in fact a lot of people are, and they're more or less verifying that this is a way of digging your way down to lower reaches on the energy landscape. But whether these are the single energy landscape of a single phase, or whether they're a distinct
That's what I was going to ask.
Energy length, sir.
Are they phases that, in principle, exist without having been produced by the surface diffusion?
Well, I think we're going to have to wait to see. We're not going to solve the problem by molecular dynamics very easily, either, because we're talking processes at extremely long timescales here. So, but you may with emulsion measurements, and there are various. I'm sure there are a lot of ideas floating around. How can we get into this? This is only about 2 years old, this phenomenology, now. But I'm looking forward to the time when you can see the results for the ethyl cyclohexane, because I'm not going to show you. No, I don't feel at liberty to do so, but I know something about what's there.
So what this shows nicely is preparation protocol dependence, that things depend strongly on preparation protocol.
Well, I would say that is a correct description of over here. But over here, it's more than just preparation. Here, it's the preparation has allowed you to get into a brand new thermodynamic state.
But you get it by depositing, right?
You get it by depositing.
That's protocol, right?
That's right. That's
so,
right.
So how does that fit into the picture of?
It fits in because
equilibrium or thermodynamics of the preparation protocol.
It's only saying that the preparation protocol allows you to leapfrog this kinetic barrier here between the glass transition and the state which is being predicted from the equilibrium behavior here. The theory is saying this this accelerating heat capacity here is a reflection of an oncoming phase transition which we can't see because we get trapped there by the kinetics. And this is a way of getting past that kinetic barrier so you can see the real thermodynamics of the supercooled liquid. At least that's the point of view that I'm pushing, and on the basis of which I'm making predictions which in the course of time you'll be able to see whether they're right or not.
Mark Ettinger thinks that because the diffusion is faster on the surface, than that the molecules are exploring their state space a lot faster, that what he's doing is equivalent to waiting a billion years and getting himself deeper into the low temperature glass phase below TG.
Yeah.
He's very coy about this.
He's very cautious, and I would be too.
Right,
and
rightfully so. He doesn't know for sure.
Right, and I'm always cautious to say that he doesn't buy this scenario by any means at all.
It's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, but it's one which, when before Mark's first paper on this was published, I got a call from the editors of Science, and they told me about this, and then they said, "What do you think? It's interesting." You say, "You bet I think it's interesting," because it was just what we were looking for. But that doesn't mean it's going to turn out to be correct. Of course, this is a forum for discussion. I think I'm putting up ideas which I hope are interesting and which have the possibility of being verified. But it's all up for discussion as an attempt to bring in some unification to a very complex phenomenon. And it goes a little bit further. Can I go a little bit further? Or?
Yeah. This is the KITP.
It's a KITP. Okay, well now. So now here's a case, which is a simple model, which is kinetically accessible, where we can test some of these things. This is the Hugler model. or at least the Hagler model with an attractive component to it. The two-length scale model that's been explored in detail by Gene Stanley's group, and there's some pioneering preliminary work done by Gibson and Wilding in the UK. And it's a isotropic system. This pair potential is isotropic, so there's no angular forces like you have to put in to get germanium to do its thing, and yet it has a liquid-liquid critical point, pretty unambiguous, because, and it also has two phases, because we can get two different glass transitions out of the high and low density forms of the liquid which are generated below the critical point. But here's the evidence for the critical point in it. This is at a pressure which is very close to the critical pressure. This is at 0.25, where the critical pressure is at 0.24. So above the critical point, we have this line of damped transitions, not coexistence, but the Widom line, as Gene likes to call it. And as you go to pressures increasingly far from that critical point, these spikes die out and move to high, and the heat capacity component is pushed to higher temperatures. Yeah, this is something which can be studied by anybody who wants to put in the program for the Hagler model, and now there are continuous versions of this coming out which have got basically the same properties. And so here's a liquid system with a liquid-liquid critical point in it, and the point I want to make is that this critical point here is phenomenologically, it's indistinguishable from the lambda transition. In the lambda transition in a continuous system, it hasn't... I need the phase diagram here. Anyway, it's just the lattice gas model tells you that it's a lambda transition. And here it's been cut off by the same sort of glass transition kinetics which cut off the lambda transition in the cobalt ion system, behaving very similarly. And you can read about that in this recent JCP paper. And I've drawn in the arrows because here's a case where with the right analysis you'll be able to establish that the correlation lengths are increasing as you come towards the Widom line crossing from the high temperature side and likewise from the low temperature side.
Can you have a model like that? Must be able to see different features in those different phases. I mean, one must be denser.
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, in this case, there's a huge difference in density, and it's an acoordinated crystal state. The low density phase crystallizes. Once it crosses the coexistence line, or once you've got it in the high density phase and you bring it down into the low density phase domain without it crystallizing, you can show that it doesn't crystallize. So that there's some distinction between the high density phase crystallizes, but the low density phase, no, it's the other way around. Low density phase crystallizes.
In a very rough sense, this dip, you know, must at low enough temperatures trap neighbors and cause different structures.
That's probably why the low density.
The radial distribution functions, of course, are available for the two phases in that paper there.
Yeah.
And they're not hugely different. They're both high coordinated. But the distance.
I think in this one, basically, the high and low density phases are just different by the mean distance.
Yeah.
Because you have sort of two length scales, whereas
One length scale must dominate the
depending on the pressure, and it's very like
the pressure and the temperature.
You know, I think what happens here is that the low density is within this longer length scale, which is near the attractive minimum.
Yeah.
So it should crystallize more easily because there's a local attraction, and high densities you probably get the smaller repulsive wall length scale.
Yeah, the more particles up. This is very like the metal, since this is a metallic glass symposium, very like the metal cerium, which has got a schizophrenic F electron, and can act like it's got two different sizes. And I don't know how many of you know, but the phase diagram of crystalline cerium has got a critical point in it.
Is this from where?
The cerium crystalline state has got a a critical point in between two face-centered cubic crystals. Now, there's no change in symmetry, so it can have a critical point. And that's well studied. I've got this beautiful diamond cell study from Lip and people in PRL, which shows this critical point. It looks just like a set of, like a classical physical chemistry textbook, Van der Waals isotherms plot. But anyway, so this is a system which deserves more study, and there'll be other versions of it. And it's not an accident that a cerium aluminum glass has been made which has a apparent polyamorphic phase transition under pressure. Maher and his group at your place, John Hopkins, has shown that. Sorry, Robin's here. Anyway, so that's there's one more section to go. Am I permitted to finish? This is bringing in some more metallic glass stuff. Yeah?
For a second, it looked like Santa Barbara.
Well, yes, exactly. And there's a point break there in the waves on where the sun and swell will go for a kilometer there. You can ride that wave. And this is, I've got two sons that love to surf, and this is why this picture is in here, actually. it's a special place.
Where is it?
It's at Coolangatta in Queensland. It's the New South Wales Queensland border. Very nice spot.
Nobody that politicians here wouldn't allow any high-rise buildings like that.
Well, we've got a spot at the top of this one, so with binoculars you can keep an eye on what's going on down there. Anyway, so that's because I wanted this a little bit relation to neutron scattering and light scattering and four-point correlation functions and a couple of things like that. So if we're right, then an important practical consequence is that the light scattering from silica fibers should decrease when the fiber is annealed at lower temperatures. So we go and search this out in the literature, and such data as there are is from these Japanese workers, but I think it'll be quickly verifiable from X-ray scattering from these silica fibers. Shows that, sure, as the fictive temperature goes down, the light scattering goes down, consistent with the correlation lengths for the density fluctuations in this case.
Present seems to go, present means what? The previous and the present is in the original.
Well, there are three present ones, and they're verifying this previous one, and there's no new point up there. So you can say, okay, a little bit flaky, but I think it's encouragement for other people to get interested and do this, because there's, why is there interest in this? Because if you want to get the maximum fluence through a silica element of the Livermore giant laser system, you want the light scattering to be as small as possible. And this is a clue, something you should be watching out for. Try and diminish that scattering. Actually, the problems are greatest at the edge of their lenses at the moment from imperfections in the surface, so that this is not an immediate bonanza to them. But so anyway, it's an illustration of the sort of thing you can find in the literature for the case of silica glass. How about the bulk metallic glass systems? No doubt this has been talked about a lot here, but we have the strong and fragile extremes, and some of the best metallic glass formers are pretty much on the strong end, or at least stronger than just about any of the molecular liquids that you'll find. In fact, I could say stronger than any of them. And what phenomena do they have going on in them? Well, here's something which seems pretty unambiguous from the group of Ralph Busch in Saarland's University. We're taking the Bill Johnson VIT-1 composition, starting at low temperatures and measuring the viscosity, they find that there's a hysteresis or a time dependence comes in up here. And if they hold the glass at this point, the liquid, I should say, because it's above its melting point at this point, it will become less viscous, and then it will remember that as you go down in temperature until it gets to a certain temperature when something thermodynamic, presumably, tunes in and says, go back where you came from. So Ken Kelton was talking about phase transitions here, but this is even more provocative, and I don't know whether this has come up yet here. Probably not, because this is still in press, but it was given formally at a meeting in Barcelona three or four weeks ago, and it's a compendium of work from a group in China. Bien, you know, I've never met Bien, but you know him, I'm sure. And his co-workers, who have measured these rare earth glasses. Here's one with a lot of cerium in it. Not accidental that there's only two components here. And what are they finding? They're showing that the viscosity measured down near the glass transition after you've made the glass and you measure it coming up in temperature is following a strong liquid pattern. But if you take the very same composition and you melt it and you measure the viscosity at high temperatures, it's incompatible with a strong liquid behavior. Any depiction of its properties is going to make it look fragile. And there's, yeah.
How do you know that's not just that this complicated mixture of things is segregating or changing its...
Well, I don't know, but you, this one here, you know, that's a complicated mixture of stuff, too.
Yeah, that's true, and a very familiar one. But again, I've always thought that, and I didn't know whether to trust the viscosity measurements at the high temperatures, because I didn't know whether this was really the same stuff that I was looking at the near the glass.
Well, it's a reasonable question to ask. It's up to them to prove it. I'm not saying I believe everything I show you, but I'm saying this is what's available at the moment for us to look at. And it's really interesting because it fits right in with some of this other stuff. I mean, the other stuff is starting to make it believable.
How many times do they cycle that to make sure that they're seeing something?
I only see once. But I think Ralph is a little bit... serious. I think he's probably did it more than once. Yeah. So
very interesting things. But when you've got something like as complex as that, there's just so many different things that can happen.
Yeah. You know Zhukutov?
No.
He's works out of Stockholm. He's got something going very like this with a single component, a single atom with a one of these funny potentials that you know goes down like this and then comes up.
On his computer. He doesn't have it in the lab, but he has it on his computer.
That's right. Okay. Well, a lot of good things start in computers.
Oh, I love I'm a theorist.
I know. That's why I took the liberty of saying it. Sid.
So, Austin, before you leave this point, could you go back to your previous slide? The one before this.
Oops. This one.
That one. If you look at the lower left-hand corner, I think what you're saying, and I'm trying to see, like, understand what you just said. What we're looking at here are two transitions, two crossovers. If I start at high temperature, I have a strong behavior.
High temperature got fragile.
Right. Doesn't match up with the strong behavior at very low temperature.
Right.
So if the two have to meet up, like what you just sketched for the red line, that suggests there are two crossovers. Strong to fragile, fragile back to strong. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I'm saying that this system is acting very like water. Do I have the water picture here? I don't think so. But water is doing very much the same. Most of the, if you look at the, not the viscosity, but the entropies of different liquids that I started at the beginning with, and then you put the entropy of water on it, it does the same sort of thing. It starts off strong and it crosses over to fragile.
Right, all right. If that's what you're saying, then we have independent evidence for that behavior for silica.
For silicon.
No, silica.
Silica. Well, that's great.
We look at the viscosity that we calculated for silica. It actually shows these crossovers.
Well, it certainly should, because above that peak in the heat capacity, which I showed you Binder omitted to make clear, it should be fragile up there. It's on the fragile side, and this is getting close to my conclusion about strong and fragile liquids, that fragile liquids exist on the high temperature flank of this generalized order disordered transition, and fragile liquids are on the high temperature side. Did I say that wrong? That the strong ones are on the low temperature flank and fragile on the high, and they're separated in between. And the challenge for these guys is to get some thermodynamics in here and show us that there's a heat capacity anomaly or maybe a first order phase transition going on in there. And they just have to do the same sort of calculation that Francis Starr did for water. Accumulate the data and believe in the laws of thermodynamics and assume a continuity and see what it looks like.
Well, we didn't do it for water, but we did it for silica.
Well, great. I want to see it. But I don't find it terribly surprising. Even if you did it when you first saw it. But no, I think it's very consistent with this fragile to strong crossover that Peter Poole, I think, and Francesco Sciortino put in the literature the first time. And that, let me see, something missing from here. Well, let me, Now, let me look at this, which is maybe germane to what you just said. So here's the picture I see with respect to this progression from strong liquid behavior with a peak at high temperatures, but a rounded peak, getting sharper as you come down. Here's the water case with its near critical lambda anomaly. And then at low temperatures, we're seeing, these are the fragile liquids now, we're seeing only this side of the transition and ends up in a first order transition like it does at the when it crosses the coexistence line down here. So it's linking everything to a sort of a central critical point, which most systems are going to miss completely, and depending on how far they miss it, they'll be relatively insensitive to the fluctuations that go, but if they're close like water, then they'll see a big effect. And above the critical point, though, you won't get any first-order phase transitions. You'll only get smeared out memories of it, just like you see in liquid argon at above its critical point, where I have a picture which shows those data, but I don't seem to see it. And here's Ken Kelton's titanium zirconium nickel with a dramatic decrease in surface tension around the same point that Ralph Bush was seeing his hysteresis. And they're similar systems, they're not identical. Density inflection. He's not too confident about this specific heat maximum, but it may be there. These are tentative measurements, so he sent me these, gave me permission to show these data, but he's got this possible specific heat maximum in it. Now here's a point for the metallic glass people. I'm not too sure about this one. The metallic glass cases have got me fascinated, but also puzzled. And I don't know what to think. But here's a very interesting case of gold, lead, bismuth that from John Perepesco's group. And when I first saw these are bulk metal, and these are emulsified metal. And I knew the glass temperature was down here somewhere. I said, this just can't go on. And so, where is this? I'm losing track of stuff here. I'm sorry. Something's going on. I should have stopped a few minutes ago, shouldn't I?
That's the beauty of this. I'm going back and forth.
It's going to be probably, well, that's one you want to see, yeah. So here's the glass transition down here. I said, how can that keep on going like that? So I found a paper from Hecht and Bill Johnson on this, which showed these data. Now, I don't know what to make of them. Metallic glass people here can maybe help, but this was the differential scan calorimeter scan with a integral heat here related to the glass transition. They say that's the glass transition. And when you see an overshoot like that, it's because the system was annealed below the glass transition. So it builds up a reserve of enthalpy, which then has to be deficiency, so that it has to come back in a rush and it gives you a peak. But so you can take this number here and say, well, probably it annealed at room temperature, and you can attribute this to the difference between glass and liquid at between 25 degrees and 44.5 degrees centigrade. And that then turns out to be a ridiculously small jump in heat capacity, 2 joules per mole. We put that 2 joules per mole, oops, onto this diagram, and you have behavior at the glass transition here, but behavior in the liquid here. Well, the only, if this is right, this is a phase transition in the liquid state, consistent with the implications of that other strong fragile. See, if this is now in metastable equilibrium here above the glass transition, and it's only jumped 2 joules per mole, then somehow you have to go from this metastable liquid heat capacity to this metastable liquid heat capacity. And you can only do that with a dramatic, either a first order transition, like you see in silicon, or some major spike in the heat capacity. So that's a puzzle.
You said that they did some funny trick to get this piece of the thing that was in the liquid. What did they do?
They've got a way of coating the individual droplets with some sort of a oxide coating, which then minimizes the chances of a nucleus, a nuclear producing fluctuation.
So it somehow suppresses the nucleation of the crystal.
Yeah. And this is legitimate. This works for a lot of the work we did on water, for instance, which was later verified by bulk measurements, used the same trick.
Why do you think that's going to have exactly the same properties as the liquid phase?
Because these particles are something like 10,000 atoms in diameter. That's a macroscopic system.
Okay, look, there's a standard technique for suppressing nucleation. Turnbull used it and stuff like that. And then what happens is that the little particles that do have nuclei or heterogeneous nucleation centers will drop out, and then you just keep what's left. But the question then is, well, how far? You've got a very, very constrained samples.
How constrained is it? It was 10,000 atoms across. That's what 1 micron amounts to when it comes to metallic atoms.
It's extremely interesting.
I think from my own experience with water, you get the bulk behavior. You can overlap.
Yeah, emulsion. I know that it was. In fact, I think Turnbull got it with mercury and stuff.
Yes, he was the first one to use those droplet experiments, and that's what Pesco is doing. I don't know. This is always.
With the 10 experiments, you yourself had some questions about what confinement does. Right?
Well, when you get down to 2 or 3 molecules in diameter, that's a different matter.
So that's a lot of work. So the sizes are very different.
Yeah. Mm. But this itself, your assurance is tens of thousands of atoms.
Well, 1 micron?
They're bigger than that.
These particles are about 2 to 5 microns in diameter, I think, and they are in the case of I've always thought of micron as macroscopic, provided the composition is the same.
But you're saying it's encased in a solid, so is there some, to what degree is the pressure potentially changing?
That's a reasonable question. It could, but that would tend to depress the heat capacity rather than exaggerate it.
Well, how do you know which way it's going to go?
Because I know that compressibility is always decreased by increasing pressure, and I think I have enough. I do have some.
The other possibility is, are the droplets that condensed, the crystallized, the ones that had more, say, lead in them, and the ones that you're left with have a different composition?
Oh, that's a possibility. Yeah, I don't know about that. It's a near eutectic composition, so I don't know whether the mixing of these, the question you need to ask there is it ideal positive or ideal negative mixing? If it's ideal negative, then there'll be the composition fluctuations will be diminished over a random. If it's ideal positive deviation, the other way.
You may have more fluctuations then.
Now, people like to think that but those fluctuations, better than anyone else that the crystal fluctuations are minuscule thermodynamically. But we're talking here about composition fluctuations.
And near eutectic, and that could be.
Well, it depends whether that eutectic is associated with a positive deviation from ideality or a negative, and you can have them both. And in metallic glass formers, usually you're relying on negative deviations to get the melting point down, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, is that Santa Barbara?
So I think that that's much more likely to be negative. I think I need to stop talking.
These are also your pictures, though?
Indeed, no. This is some kind of desktop person. Yeah. I don't know whether you did ask about this. This is the case of, and it brings us to the four-point correlation function. So this is from Chen's experiment on this water in a nanoscopic subdivision in this cement stuff. So you can make up your own mind what sort of water it is, but it's kind of interesting whatever it is, because it's got a peak in the heat capacity, a little bit like the one I showed you before. And now they're scattering neutrons off it, and let's give it to them that they're scattering with expertise. They're defining the intermediate scattering function here. I do think it is F1, at least that's what it looks like. And here's their chi, what is it called? Chi, anyway, it's the thing that you get out of neutron scattering relating to this X susceptibility function here in tau. Also shows a peak when plotted as a function of time at constant Q, the height of which is proportional to some sort of dynamic correlation length. Although somewhere else in the paper they said that maybe it's more of a static correlation, I'm not sure. Because whatever it is, it goes through a maximum where the heat capacity goes through a maximum. And so if you say a dynamic correlation length, then it's no longer increasing as you go towards the glass temperature. On the other hand, if they do the simulation, the MD simulation, and they get Berthier's four-point correlation function, then it continues to increase up here as you go down below. So there's a distinction there which, as far as I can understand, is unresolved. I believe it's consistent with that inequality that he comes up with. But
so there are general expectations on how the stretching exponent behaves across this?
The stretching exponent?
Across this compressibility maximum.
No, but if the fluctuation is determining it large enough, then it'll go back to single exponential behavior.
How strongly would you say that?
Well, it depends on how close you are to the critical point then, because I wouldn't mind betting if I look at that Hugler model. So if you do the correlation function, I lost it here. At this point here, I wouldn't mind betting it's exponentially relaxing there, because you're dealing with the relaxation of big clusters. Depends on whether you're, it depends on whether you're looking at something like the diffusivity, which is probably decoupled from the viscosity here. This whole business of the decoupling of diffusion from viscosity with supercooled liquids that people have paid a lot of attention to is to be interpreted in these terms, because as you come down towards a critical point, at least at the gas-liquid critical point, the diffusion coefficient behaves normally, but the viscosity diverges. So Stokes-Einstein equation is automatically going to show you a big increasing failure as the fluctuations get bigger and affect the viscosity more. Now that same sort of thinking should apply equally well to this.
What are you saying about
I'm saying that there's an interesting question here, and Gene has partly answered it already. The Stokes-Einstein equation, which everybody talks about as failing as you go below the mode coupling critical point, finds a natural explanation in terms of underlying criticality, because we know that for sure at the gas-liquid critical point, the diffusion coefficient doesn't diverge, but the viscosity does. Mm-hmm. And then that should apply equally well down here, as far as I can tell, but I'm not sure, it has to be proven. But at least diffusion should show much smaller divergence than the viscosity as you come in towards this peak in the heat capacity here. And so that when you examine liquids up here, asking about the deviation from the Stokes-Einstein equation, you can expect it for more fragile liquids because they're the ones which are closer to this sub-TG transition. And you don't expect it for the strong liquids, because they don't know anything about this down below TG. Like the cyclohexane, for which I'm predicting no Edinger phase. I think it's coffee.
I'm trying to summarize what you're saying and also some questions. So I think the first statement is probably at least I find it easy to accept, and it may be interesting to keep that in mind looking at glass formers, is that in a lot of these systems you might expect a liquid-liquid transition. And this might influence how you look at your data to understand what's going on. I mean, so this statement looks okay to me. This used to show a lot of examples of different kinds of systems where this might be happening, right? Mm-hmm. Now the second statement you're making, which looks plausible, but I don't know if this is really a strong statement, is that for strong liquids you are always looking at, I mean, when I look at strong behavior, I'm always looking at a system which has liquid-liquid transition phenomenology. I'm looking at the low temperature phase. Mm-hmm. This is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe true. Certainly, maybe true for some cases, but is it generally true? Is not clear. Right.
Don't have many examples of it.
Mm-hmm. The third point is whether this is a framework for looking at all glass-forming liquids. And here it seems to me that, in general, there is no reason to expect any kind of cooperative behavior that might lead to a liquid-liquid transition in an arbitrary liquid that forms, that is a glass former. And therefore, I shouldn't expect this to be a general framework which will describe all the glass formers that I look at. Would you agree with these statements, or?
Partially the last one. I don't have much to say about what I call intermediate liquids. I don't know what's going on with them, but I can't exclude that this is still relevant, because if you go more than a certain distance from a critical point, you're not going to see any remembrance of it at all. Now, the fragile liquids, I still think we have quite a lot to say about, because we have this in several lines pointing to a sub-TG phase transition, which is related to, I mean, I did show that.
So I can ask the question, why should some arbitrary glass former, which shows fragile liquid, have the possibility of a liquid-liquid transition? This is not clear, no? I mean, because that needs new physics, which may not be there.
Because it has a heat capacity which is behaving like this, and we don't at the moment have any model which describes that very well. The random energy model does predict an inverse temperature squared dependence for the heat capacity, no, I guess. Yeah. But I don't know. That's
depending on how the configuration changes. With temperature, I can have this behavior. So the point is, you're trying to link this very closely to the heat capacity behavior near a thermodynamic, liquid gas type thermodynamic transition. Right?
Not liquid gas type, but the liquid-liquid type.
It's
phenomenology. And then I want to turn to these plastic crystal cases and see them not as having a single critical point, but probably a line of lambda transitions, because they're center of mass ordered. I think that prevents them from having a single critical point. But look, there's a lot of this is still rather dimly perceived in my mind. I'm struggling like everybody else. But I think that there are now these experimental probes. You see a very fragile liquid, and this says, let's do some vapor deposition studies and see what we get. And we haven't looked at the most fragile liquids yet. We have this decalin and the nitrogen cousin of it, which are extremely fragile. I'm not at all sure that they're going to do the same thing, because I think this fragility has different sources, probably. It can be...
That's the point. I mean, so this kind of liquid-liquid transition may be additional physics that may arise in some systems.
Yes,
it's one more thing to think about in looking at supercooled liquids, but that's not going to explain the behavior of all supercooled liquids.
It'd be very surprising if it did. I think it's a framework to keep in mind and to judge things against, but to look for exceptions for too. And I can suggest cases which would be good exceptions to.
For strong liquids, you think this is really?
Well, I'm pretty confident for strong liquids that this correlation length going inversely to the popular idea is probably good.
Okay.
So you said that it will actually decrease for strong liquids. The strength scale will actually decrease as you're coming towards the glass.
Yes, yeah. And I think that that's one which can be established on a fairly short time scale by computer simulations of systems like the Hagler model.
But it's not always clear, I mean, what correlation to look for. Then there is a static length scale, but I mean, what is the correlation?
I would look in the enthalpy fluctuations, because the compressibility shows a diminishing effect in the excess compressibility, which is what everybody says. The density fluctuations are not important. But the enthalpy fluctuations go in the opposite direction. Oh, and here's, thanks for making the point. When we pass from fragile liquids to strong liquids, I can make just the opposite statement. In the strong liquids, the jump in heat capacity is diminutive, but if I look to the light scattering data in the silica, just above the glass transition, there's a giant jump in the compressibility. Goes up by a factor of 3. So where the jump in compressibility at TG is very small and uninteresting for fragile liquids, for the strong liquids, it's the opposite. And that's available in the light scattering studies of Cole and Kirkjian, and there's a Japanese group that has the same result.
So I think the behavior in water has been, if I'm not mistaken, it's published, but it's been also shown by Biman Bhatch and his students that you do have this going through a maximum of the peak value of the...
Okay, in a simulation.
The four-point correlation.
Oh, okay, okay. Yeah, okay.
Good. Would you expect something for strong glass formers as you cooled for decoupling or the Stokes-Einstein variation? And you gave this analogy to critical phenomena where the diffusion constant was regular and the viscosity was divergent.
Yeah, good point. I think it's there's experimental data on this point that the Stokes-Einstein equation or at least the iron equation applies well to silica. The diffusion coefficient of silicon in silicon dioxide experimentally is 10 to the minus 22 meters squared per second, rather than some higher diffusivity. That's what you predict from the viscosity. So there's no decoupling in the case of silica, the stronger.
Very little, I think.
Yeah.
But in the case of water on a computer, didn't Francis Starr and Peter Poole look at this? And I thought they saw a strong, this water might be, didn't they see strong decoupling?
They did above the critical point, in the fragile region, yes, and rightly so, yeah.
So I guess that's the issue, what region you're in, where is that critical point?
They can't tell below.
PRL.
So I think my so sort of summary of what might be happening is, I mean, you will see Stokes-Einstein breakdown even in these systems well above this compressibility maximum. But you will see a very strong increase when you go from fragile liquid to strong liquid side.
Strong increase
of the breakdown, the Stokes-Einstein parameter.
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure that's right.
No, because there's a lot of work that does show that the Stokes-Einstein breakdown occurs at fairly high temperatures, in the onset temperature.
Yeah, I mean, the simulations have found.
Right. So, but then it's just a question of how strong is the breakdown. So, I mean, there's certainly reasons to believe that when it's crossed this line, there is a sharp increase in the breakdown, but it's not necessarily where it starts.
I would have expected it to diminish again, if anything, to go for a maximum at the Wynnum line crossing.
Yeah.
And that's been interesting to check.
Yeah.
Okay.